Let's talk about revolutionary simplicity. We don't think of Jesus often enough as a revolutionary. Revolutionary sort of has a negative connotation to it, but nonetheless, he was a revolutionary. We started our series on simplicity with a message entitled Stop the River. In other words, stop everything that's going on so I can think long enough, analyze, assess, look at, and reflect upon my life to understand where complexity needs to be eliminated, if not minimized, if not eradicated, and where simplicity could be accentuated in our life. Joshua was crossing the River Jordan, and God stopped the river all the way back to the beginning. And I think it's important for us to do that every now and again. While we're accentuating simplicity, why not accentuate that in your personal devotions? Why not stop, pray, think, look, assess what's going on in your life that is bringing you to a place of busyness rather than productivity, to chaos rather than efficiency, the use of your time, the use of your talents, the use of your resources. Stop the river. Last week we talked about the need for systems. Systems in life dictate behavior. Do you have a systematic approach, as God did in creation, with a certain cadence, a sequence to what it is you're doing in your life? Are you just living life on accident, or are you living life on purpose? Is life happening to you, or are you more proactive handling what's going on in your own life? Are you preparing in this season of your life to move forward with some sort of plan? Or is this just happenstance, trying to make it by? And today we talk about this revolutionary Jesus Christ. Let's take a look at how the world accentuates simplicity in marketing. I think one of the most simplistic, well, there it is. You see that apple, you pretty much know it. You don't need any words for that icon. You know it means apple. You know the connotations and what's associated with that. You could go anywhere in the world and see the Nike swoosh and know exactly what it means. Just do it. You know exactly what it means. And it's not only Apple and Nike, it's Coke and McDonald's, Shell oil. You don't even need the word Shell. You look at it and you immediately know, because of consistency and redundancy and simplicity, what that means. And the church would do well to take that such an approach of simplicity in what it is we do. That golden arch image right there is interesting. You immediately know what it is, but it takes on different connotations at different times in history, doesn't it? At one time, it was the place you wanted to be more than anything else. And sometimes it's not the place you want to be. It's interesting, but nonetheless, simplicity. Not the Gap, just Gap. I mean, I immediately looked at that, and I know I'm going to pay more than I probably want to for a pair of jeans. I immediately know that. It's very simple. So simplicity in the marketplace pays big dividends. So let's look at Jesus and his simplicity and Jesus as a revolutionary. The word revolution is defined as a forcible overthrow. Forcible overthrow of a government in favor of a new system. Think about that for a minute. A forcible overthrow of a government. Do you need how you govern your life and manage your resources and time to be overthrown for a new system and a new approach? First question I have for you today. Jesus is seeking to be a revolutionary on a personal level in your life. Stop the river. Let's look at this. Jesus and his ministry, both 2,000 years ago and even today, revolts against complexity. Any complexity that hides or diminishes him or minimizes him, he revolts against it. Jesus revolts against religiosity and its complexities if, in fact, it hides or dismisses him in any way, shape, or form. Any religious system that seeks to control or find you controlling another is too complex for him. He'd much rather have a more simplistic approach. Some of you have spent elongated periods of time in and out of false teaching and cults. I know this. The control in a religious environment like that is oppressive. anything but liberating, and something that Jesus, the Christ himself, would lead a revolution against. Jesus' revolutionary tactics were most pronounced and most magnified in the shadow of the temple. The temple, the very symbol of sacrifice and worship and Methodism and a systematic approach, recipes and formulaic approaches to sacrifices, and the complexity of the leadership of the Jewish religion is where he brought his message of simplicity. I mean, it was a complex religion. I mean, you had Sadducees who believed one nuance of religion. You had Pharisees who believed a little bit of a different. You had a Sanhedrin, 23 to 70 people who met as religious tribunals in different towns. They had decision-making ability. You had Essenes that were ascetic separatists that lived an ascetic, peaceful, simple life of worship and scribing out the scrolls and taking ritual baths. And you had, in the middle of that, you had spiritual terrorists called zealots who would just as soon pull out a knife and cut you and kill you in the market and keep walking. You had all kind of demeanor and behavior going on in a religious context, all in the name of God. You even had Herodians, Hellenistic Jews, who had their bent on the whole thing. This Baskin-Robbins 31 flavors of religious leadership is how he entered and revolted against that such complexity with a message of simplicity. If the religion wasn't complex enough, certainly the region was. Complex, oppressive, heavy taxation. Not only taxation of the Russians, but the Russians. What am I thinking? The Romans. That was interesting. The complex taxation of the Romans and the tax collectors who took their cut on top of the exorbitant taxes. The ongoing visual military presence. The oppressiveness and the symbolism of "you are beneath us" constantly added to a level of complexity to their life. And the persecution which associated with it. So the religious system, complex. Let me tell you how complex this was. How many of you actually tweet? Okay, Cody tweets. Anthony tweets. All right. Those of you, well, you ought to have a pretty big following. Nobody's wondering any other tweets. They ought to be catching up on yours. 140 characters, I believe, is what you're allowed. 140 characters. If you can't say what you want to say in 140 characters, like, don't tweet. These religious people back in the day added up the characters of the Ten Commandments and came up with 613. Then researched the laws in the Old Testament and came up with the same number, 613. Decided in that complexity of all that was about that they would assign 365 negative commandments of God in the Old Testament, one per day. How about starting each and every day with a negative commandment? Yes! And on top of that, they took the balance of 248 affirmative commands of God and littered them throughout the year, coming up with a total of 613 laws to be obeyed. As if that wasn't enough, they started between 33 AD up to 400 AD, and they started listing in what's called the Talmud additional laws, ceremonial, cultural, all kind of laws. How complex would that have been perceived to be by a person, most of whom couldn't read and couldn't count? Talk about creating a complexity that justifies your existence as a bureaucracy. Talk about justifying your job and your salary by putting together religious complexity that nobody can understand or follow, and make yourself necessary to explain it. Man, that's complex. The Israelites were governed by laws. Now, I'm not down on laws, because laws have a purpose if you understand them. Soon as you don't recognize the law of God, you have an issue, you have a problem, and things get really complex. And there's a slippery slope there. You have to be very careful. By the way, as long as we're talking about simplicity, how many of you actually served in one of the five branches of the armed forces? Okay. Did any of you have the luxury of taking a command from a superior officer and interpreting it for your own basis and acting upon it if you felt like it? Anybody have that luxury? Oh, I'm sorry. Those people would be in Leavenworth, wouldn't they? A command of God is the absolute epitome of simplicity. I'm not really interested, God says, in your opinion of what I command you to do. I'm more interested in your obedience to it. Your obedience is actually linked to your love for me. This is interesting. But for the sake of avoiding depression, we'll move on to another part of complexity and simplicity. The law has to be accentuated. The law has to be understood. Because the law will drive you and I to a place of desperation to grace and forgiveness for our inability to fulfill the law. When you understand the weightiness of the law and the commands of God, you also cannot help but conclude that Jesus, as the fulfillment of the law, should be magnified. Don't throw out the law, because you'll diminish grace. Many stop at the law and miss the good part. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. It is by grace you have been saved. Hallelujah. Make the law all that it needs to be, but it's by grace through faith that we've been saved. And this is not from ourselves. Even better. It is the gift of God, not by works, lest any man should boast. All right, the complexity of laws, the complexity of religiosity and its leadership, and the simplicity of a yoke. Okay, most rabbis of all different shapes and sizes back then would have what they would call a yoke. All right, what is that? A yoke was basically their theme in their teaching. Some would accentuate one thing over another, others would accentuate something totally different. The yoke was the essence of their subject matter of their teaching. What they most often taught, what they most often discussed, what they most often translated, and what they most often asked for application in everyday life. When you said rabbi to Jesus or master to Jesus as a teacher, you were also recognizing not only was he a teacher, but he had a yoke. He had an emphasis in his teaching. What was Jesus' yoke? In the midst of the shadow of the temple in 613 laws, 248 affirmative, 365 negative affirmations. And in the middle of all of that, Herodians, Sadducees, Pharisees, Sanhedrin, Hellenistic Jews, and Zealots, he told them what his yoke was. Come to me. I know you're going to the temple. Come to me. I know you're sitting under these oppressive religious teachings. Come to me. My yoke is different. Come to me, you who are weary, burdened, heavy laden, being squashed. Come to me, you who lack the education and the wherewithal to study and memorize the 613 laws. Come to me directly. Come to me, and I will give you rest. I don't know what these people would have been thinking. What do they want from me? I can't read. What do they want from me? I don't get it. What do they want from me? I'm trying to grow crops. I can't go to school. What do they want from me? What do they keep telling me? I'm not doing it. I'm not performing. I don't even understand it all. Do you know what the number one question is that a person wants answered before they go to a church they've never been to before? What do they wear? It's true. People want to fit in. They want to know if on Saturday night they need to stay up late and iron a skirt or just put a pair of jeans in the dryer. That's what people want to know. Will I feel comfortable when I go there? You know why they don't want to know much of anything else? Because it's so complex from a secular standpoint. If you're not accustomed to going to church, here's what it looks like. I remember this. I didn't know what a Lutheran was, Episcopalian, a Baptist. I had no idea what the Church of Christ was, this, that, and the other thing. Christian Science, I had no idea. All these flavors, all these things, I didn't know. I wanted to know whether or not I could wear jeans. I didn't know about bureaucracies, flavors, theology, doctrine, none of it. All I knew was my life wasn't going too good. And I just wanted to show up dressed appropriately so I didn't feel any more out of place than I already would have, even though I am dressed comfortably. Religiosity has a complexity to it that is difficult for people to overcome. Come to me, you who are weary, heavy laden, who don't understand the complexity of the system we put in place. How simplistic was Jesus' yoke? 613 laws, 248 body references, 365, one per day, summed up into just two. 613 down to two. That means he eliminated 611 of the 613, put them aside as not all that important in light of the two. If we can get the two, he says. If you can get the two, you're going to understand the 611 on top of that. Let's just get the two. And he said it. Jesus said to them, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment." Commandment. Not up for negotiation, interpretation. Commandment. Order. You want to follow me? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's it. Number one, numero uno. So simple. So that's it. So let's go home. That's all you got to do. It seems like there's more than that, though. Like, come on, man. Give me a little something. Give me a little something, something here. How am I going to do that? How am I, in a simplistic way, going to love the Lord my God with all my heart, my soul, and all my mind? If I could do that. Because knowing what that's about in a simplistic way, not a complex way, that's pretty important. You know, if it was just love the Lord your God with your heart, soul, mind, strength, if that's all it was, piece of cake. But there's three letters in there that mess you up. There's three letters in there that just absolutely shipwreck the whole simplicity of it at first glance. Why didn't he say this word? All. Yikes. All. All right, you had me without all. Now all, I'm not so sure. Well, I'm thinking about that one now. All. What that has to mean, without getting super complex, as I can't actually love him with all of my heart if something else is preoccupying my heart. Then I would only be able to love him with a portion of my heart, a portion of my mind, a portion of my soul. Okay, let's figure that out then. What clutters your heart? If we can figure out what clutters our heart and our mind and our soul, and we can eliminate 611 other things, boil it down to two things, if I can understand those, getting those out of my heart, mind, and soul, I actually might have the potential and the capacity to love them with all my heart. What clutters your heart? Stop the river. What clutters your heart? This is big. I mean, this is big. This is it right here. This is it. Two greatest commandments, and there's something in the way of that coming to pass. This is big. What clutters my heart? Let's talk about soul. It's the seat of your feelings, your emotions, the essence of who you are as a person. What clutters my soul? If I could actually fulfill the first and greatest commandment, even momentarily, I'd be onto something. I got to figure out how to declutter. Decluttering now has become the number one thing about this verse. Decluttering my heart and soul. But not making it too complex. Third thing, mind. A mind. Shoot. The mind, sometimes you don't even have control over it. Okay, how do I declutter my mind? What's in my mind? What's in your mind? What's been in your mind? What's been on your mind? What's been in your mind for a long time now? Let's talk about that. Because it's keeping us from the allness, the capacity, the all-inness, or the potential for all-inness to actually love the Lord our God. What you got up there? What's taken residence? What's built a home? What has its own address? What's fixated in your mind that won't move out of the area, that's taking up space to actually love the Lord your God with all your... Number one commandment, friend. Number one. I got some suggestions. Sometimes things are imprinted upon our minds. We didn't ask for them. We didn't deserve them. But they came our way. They came our way, and the seed got planted. And over the years, the culture watered it. People around us watered it. Sometimes they're not good things. They take up space. They take up water. They take up everything that you need in your mind to live. They live on a street they don't need to live on. Sometimes, I'll give you an example. The Great Depression. Those who actually lived through the Great Depression had imprinted upon their minds a perspective and an attitude towards government, banks, money, and God. I'm not faulting them for it. And the stock market. I'm not faulting them for it. I'm just saying, imprinted upon the mind of those people was an attitude and an ideology about trusting God, trusting government, trusting the value of money, and trusting banks that changed their behavior for decades after the Depression had long been gone. And some of those people raised you. You know what I'm talking about. Not faulting anybody, I'm just saying there was a house built on a cul-de-sac of those people's mind with a firm foundation in the deep basement. It wasn't moving anywhere, even when the tornadoes came. That was going to be there for a long time. Somebody got hurt by the church one day, far back, way back when, or you grew up teething by chewing on the front of the pew, or the pew in front of you, and you resent the church attendance, you resent that, you resent something that happened in the church. Imprinted on your mind, in your heart, in the essence of your soul, is some sort of ideology about the church that's hard to get rid of, and it's taking up space, and in your heart, it has its own dominion. Your definition of fatherhood was tainted in some way, shape, or form based on abandonment or something, or your mother, or your family, some catastrophic event got imprinted on your mind. And until it is decluttered and minimized, broken down, shattered, and shoveled out, it's going to take up a capacity to love the Lord your God. The civil rights movement, growing up in southern United States, imprinted upon your mind as a child was an ideology, was a way of interacting, a cultural moray that has been imprinted upon your mind that still to this day, though you try to get rid of it, has taken up some space, rooted itself in your mind, your heart, and your emotions that's keeping you now from loving the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your mind, and all of your soul. What we're afraid of, what we don't understand, takes residence in those three areas. On one perspective, it's very simple. Hey guys, you know, here I am standing here. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Oh, by the way, this is nothing new. I wrote it in Deuteronomy 6, but I'll say it again. There it is. So simple, but the decluttering of the mind, the heart, and the soul doesn't happen automatically. It happens in the context of sanctification. It happens in the context of a small group. It happens when iron sharpens iron with another believer. It happens when you're willing to go beneath the surface beneath the surface, the number one commandment, beneath the surface, beneath association with the church, beneath a Sunday worship service, beneath the surface, down under, is how you declutter, how you take out the trash. Don't conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. The renewing of your mind is the decluttering of the areas that have taken residence that keep you from loving the Lord your God with all your heart. And notice, the very same things keep you from loving your neighbor. Brilliant summation, Jesus. Brilliant. In two statements, two commandments, leaving 611 behind, he just summarized the purpose of the Christian life. To follow him with simplicity and take out the trash. Regardless of how it got there, to declutter the ideology that is in direct contradiction to his truth. You and I lack the capacity to love him with all of our heart when in our heart is anything contrary to his teaching and his yoke. In case you're not aware of it, that right there was good preaching. Those who live according to the flesh have their mind set on what the flesh desires. Those who live in accordance to the Spirit have their mind set on what the Spirit desires. All right, let's leave the Depression out of it and the Civil Rights Movement and everything else in culture. What do you think about your spouse? What do you have in your heart towards your spouse? How do you feel about your spouse? How much of your mind is preoccupied with that? And how much of your emotional well-being is hindered or enhanced by that? And how might an absence of forgiveness, how might a resentment, how might a hurt diminish your capacity to love the Lord your God with all of your heart? Apparently, this taking the trash thing out is more than once in every long while. Apparently, it's an ongoing process. What a brilliant summation! Decluttering. And the second is like it. You should love your neighbor as yourself. And on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. In the event that the statement wasn't simplistic enough, in the event that there was any lack of clarity on the definition of neighbor, if in any way, shape, or form anyone would think that a neighbor was the guy next door and that's as far as it went, or that it was just a Jew, or it was just a person in Jerusalem, or if there was any confusion whatsoever, he clarified that in advance with this statement. Two, actually. One, your neighbor is like a Samaritan. It's anybody. Oh, and then Matthew 5:44, love your enemies. Oh. Too simplistic. Too simplistic. I would say it's 200-300 times you've heard this. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. All your heart. All your heart. Man. It was a cakewalk for a minute there, wasn't it? What's the 21st century preacher's yoke? What's the 21st century preacher's yoke in the United States of America on this mountain? What should it be? All scripture is God-breathed. useful for teaching. Here it is, rebuking, correcting, training in righteousness, so that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. The more that yoke becomes the preacher's yoke, the more that person will have someone talking behind their back. The more that person will be controversial. The more that person will be not as appetizing as others. When that is the yoke, to stand where I stand and say what I say leads to conviction. Do you need a revolution? Some sort of revolution in your heart, how you think about people, who you're afraid of, who you judge, who you're prejudiced against. I don't know how it would be possible not to in this culture. We're informed and misinformed constantly. We're being smushed and conformed in molds and patterns and groups and stereotypes and camps and this and that. So often it would be hard not to have some clutter in my heart. It would almost be impossible. Take out the trash. So that's what we're going to do. Chris, would you do me a favor, please? Would you go out in the breezeway, grab the trash can, and bring it up to the corner of the altar here? Bruce, would you do the same out there in that breezeway? Bring a trash can in here. In your pew, some sort of piece of paper, and something to write on. I want to encourage you to stop the river for a few minutes. And I want you to think about writing down on a piece of paper clutter. It could be one thing, two, I don't know, clutter. If you don't have something to write with, just someone around you will give you something. Just clutter. What's taking up residence on the cul-de-sac of your mind, your soul, and your heart that's diminishing your capacity to love the Lord your God, which is the greatest commandment? What is it? And if you have an attitude about what I'm saying, write that down. That's one of them. Okay, Pastor Cody. We're going to sing these songs. Why is it important that you act upon what I just said? Because we're not just hearers of the word, we're doers. And because it means something, nobody's going to read your garbage, okay? It means something to make an action, to identify something, to write it on a piece of paper. It means something. The Bible is written on paper. It means something to write it down and then go put it in that trash can once you've come to the place of understanding that I don't really need this anymore. This is keeping me from actually walking in the freedom of actually walking in obedience to the greatest commandment ever, 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 ever. So, I don't know, whatever you want to do, walk up here, put it in the trash can. Remember that you put it in the trash can. Is it a resentment, a bitterness, an issue with your husband, your wife, your children? At least start a process. You've identified it. Now start a process of ditching it. Ditch it. Open a dialogue as you stop the river and ask God for a greater simplicity in your approach to Him in life, fellow man. There's only two relationships in life, the vertical one and the horizontal. Love. Doesn't mean you're going to be rid of it before you walk out of here. Doesn't mean that. I mean, something started, maybe something restarted, jump-started again. You now have something very pertinent to put into your prayer life. Oh, and if it's prayerlessness that you're ditching, you can open a dialogue about the capacity of your heart right now your soul and your mind. I want to say this. Somebody imprinted upon people in this room things that are not true. And then they watered them. And they repeated them. And then they lived them out. And maybe you didn't have the wherewithal to resist it, but you do now. Not only do you have the wherewithal, you have the responsibility to free yourself of the sin that so easily entangles and keep you from loving the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind. There's one race, the human race. There's one God, one creator of all mankind. Let's take out the trash. We're going to seal it in prayer by the Spirit of God. His yoke is easy, and the burden is light. I pray you experience a greater lightness as you leave here this morning. Deal with what needs to be dealt with in Jesus' name. Let's think about that as we sing.